Esther chapter 2, again. Still, different section though. Esther chapter 2, beginning at verse 12. I think we'll pretty much just stop at verse 18. Because I really do think that 19 to the end of chapter 2 belongs better with chapter 3. It actually flows better in the way that the author tells the story. But anyway, Esther chapter 2, beginning in verse 12. Now when the turn came for each young woman to go into King Ahasuerus, after being 12 months under regulations for women, since this was the regular period of their beautifying, 6 months with oil of myrrh, and 6 months with spices and ointments for women, when the young woman went in to the king in this way, she was given whatever she desired to take with her from the harem to the king's palace. In the evening she would go in, and in the morning she would return to the second harem in custody of Shaashgaz, the king's eunuch, who was in charge of the concubines. She would not go into the king again unless the king delighted in her and she was summoned by name. When the turn came for Esther, the daughter of Abihail, the uncle of Mordecai, who had taken her as his own daughter to go into the king, she asked for nothing except what Haggai, the king's eunuch, who had charge of the women, advised. Now Esther was winning favor in the eyes of all who saw her. And when Esther was taken to King Ahasuerus into his royal palace in the 10th month, which is the month of Tebeth, in the 7th year of his reign, the king loved Esther more than all the women, and she won grace and favor in his sight more than all the virgins. So he set a royal crown on her head and made her queen instead of Vashti. Then the king gave a great feast for all his officials and servants. It was Esther's feast. He also granted a remission of taxes to the provinces and gave gifts with royal generosity. So there you have it, the selection of Queen Esther. The whole process involved and everything that took place where she becomes queen. Now, just a bit of a review. We started looking at chapter 2 last week. It's where Mordecai and Esther were introduced. We finally get to meet them. The book's named after Esther, but we don't get to meet her until chapter 2. So Mordecai and Esther are there. And really, in chapter 2, we're roughly, the beginning of chapter 2 anyway, we're roughly 3 years after the events of chapter 1. And you remember part of what chapter 1 was all about was the king giving this great banquet and feast and so forth to drum up support in the third year of his reign to prepare this huge campaign against the Greeks. Well, that didn't go so well. So he's back home 3 years later. He remembers Vashti, remembers that she was deposed. He comes back. The government treasury is depleted for all practical purposes, even though Esther doesn't mention that. The historians do. And he basically, to comfort himself and console himself, moved to a whole life of complete self-indulgence in order to make himself feel better. And I'm sure the wine flowed there just as much as it did in chapter 1. He sends out an edict after he remembers that Vashti was deposed. And remember again that he didn't come up with it on his own, did he? Once again, the king is portrayed as an individual who needs to be told what to do. And that's what takes place. The folks around him, they come up with this edict. And in the midst of this edict, we're introduced to Esther and Mordecai, and she is taken too. And a key ingredient in this story is the fact that Mordecai instructed, in fact, the ESV says commanded, Esther not to tell of her lineage and her kindred, literally native land. So not to make known her people or her kindred, that is her native land. That's where we are. So everything's been set. Now we're getting ready. Verse 12 begins. Except verse 12 to 14 helps set the stage even further, getting into some of the specifics about why Esther goes in the way she does, why she goes about what she does, is that she's just following along with everybody else did. And that's where we get verses 12 to 14. It's explanatory. All of the women that were taken were subjected to this. So it gives us a reason, provides us a framework when we get to Esther herself. Right? Now, you read through 12 to 14, and what do you think? What do you think about it?
Definitely a male-centered society.
Yeah, very male-centered society, right. Don't you find it kind of odd? A little bit odd?
It wouldn't go over today.
No, it wouldn't go over today. Probably in most cultures, actually, it probably wouldn't go over today. A year of these beauty treatments. 6 months, oil of myrrh. And then after that, another 6 months. Yeah, Amy?
I think the comparison to like a Miss America contest or something, it's really pretty good. There's, you know, it sounds like people really liked her. Were they taking votes?
Yeah, almost.
And then that kind of treatment, those girls, they spend years.
Years and years.
Contest.
Yeah.
Every aspect.
Mm-hmm. They have to have a talent. You know, they've got to be able to answer articulately certain questions.
They have to be in perfect shape.
Perfect shape, yep, everything. And it's similar.
Yeah.
Except they wouldn't be part of the king's harem.
Yeah, right. That's definitely true. That's the key difference there. There's not much difference in one sense because it's objectifying. I don't care what anybody says. That's what the Miss America contest does.
Yeah.
It just simply does that. And in that sense, there's nothing here different. So 12 months of beauty treatments that all of the women are going through. Now, you know, we sit here and we think, well, you know, you just go to the nearest Walmart, pick up some CoverGirl, and we're all set. But that's not really what goes on here. What we've got, first of all, we need to understand that in Persia and India and even Saudi Arabia at the time, spices and things like that, these kinds of oils were a major export. So they really did have, in a lot of sense, an abundance. But it was also because it was an export, ways they made money. So if the king's using a lot of this in such a detail, he's kind of using up a source of revenue, or at least a section of it. And I'm sure there was plenty that went out, but you know, we're not told how many women. It's left to the imagination that it was probably more than a couple. So you have all this going on and all those spices all at once. It'd be, you know, you go to Walmart, you go to the CoverGirl section, and a whole bunch of women just clean out the aisle. And that's almost the image that's described here. Now, these spices and lotions, as I said, a major export for the region. It was the wealthy and the powerful who used it, and they usually used a lot of it. Now, how did they go about doing this? Well, this is where it gets a little bit interesting. Maybe some of you at various times have had such bad head colds that you kind of steam up some hot water and some other things in there, and you kind of drape a towel over your head, and you just kind of hang there and let the steam come up to try to help aerate you as best you can. And I don't know to what degree it helps. Probably does a little, you know, the humidity and so forth. But in a sense, it seems to be that that's the way that they beautified themselves. What has been uncovered in a number of archaeological digs, not simply in the area of Susa or Babylon or really throughout that whole Near East region, are what they called these spice burners. They were these cubes in which these spices would be burned, and so the aroma would come and permeate. And so what the women in this case would simply do is, and it's not simply just draping their head, they would take long robes and drape over it so that the aroma would just completely permeate their bodies every day. I don't know how long they did it, but it was a constant thing. So you think of this as a daily treatment, and how long, they didn't have iPods or anything like that to sit there and let this go on. I don't know how long it took, but it's an everyday thing. And you think about it, we think about things in our own homes that, you know, you worry or you want. It could go either way, things that you don't want versus and things that you do want, that you want to aerate your house or not aerate your house, as the case may be. And, you know, some things that just gets into the walls and you just can never get it out. And you think of people who, since we're talking about this specific region, you know, I used to live in apartment buildings. I used to live on the 23rd floor. And we'd go up and down the elevators all the time. The elevator would stop at a particular floor. People get in and off. But I could always tell immediately the floors that had Indians living there. Always. Can you guess why?
Curry.
The smell of curry. Because they cook in it all the time. It's not a bad thing. I like curry. You know, when folks bring stuff made with curry, I'm right there. And, you know, they say the same thing about garlic. If you have too much garlic, you kind of sweat it out your pores even. That's a lot of garlic. But this is the idea. This is what's taking place. And so each of the women, they're taking their turns under these spice burners, which in some cases would maybe be used for incense and religious festivities. But as one commentator, well, commentator quoting another commentator, indicates that they were probably also, you can think of them as cosmetic burners, that they were also used for that purpose, to drape oneself over and let the aroma constantly permeate. And so, you see there in verse 12, 6 months of oil of myrrh. I don't even know what myrrh smells like. Does anybody know? Yeah, me neither. I have no idea.
I smelled it at some point, but it isn't something I could describe.
Yeah. Yeah.
It was something a missionary brought to us from some place.
Okay.
And shared it with a woman's Bible study.
Oh, just to give it a smell and see what it's like. Okay, so oil of myrrh. And then you also have 6 months with spices and ointments for women. So there's not much description of that, just various spices that would permeate. And you got to figure the ointments were important in a very arid region. Sue says, we mentioned in one of the first ones we talked about in this, was that the summers there were unbearably hot. And so desert regions and so forth, they've always got something to help keep the skin smooth, because, you know, you think it gets dry here. It was pretty bad.
It still gets hot there.
Yeah, it's still that way. And, you know, you think of our soldiers that are over there in those temperatures, you know, 110, 115, 120, easy, on a regular basis. And they're sucking down a couple gallons of water just to stay hydrated. So, you know, the ointments were there for the skin treatment and so forth. But generally, it was for the rich and the wealthy and the powerful, the people of position. Yes?
Did they eat, like, particular foods?
They probably did. In fact, we do know that that was the case. Back in, where is it? Right, verse 9 of chapter 2. And the young woman, this is Esther, pleased him and won his favor, and he quickly provided her with her cosmetics and her portion of food, and with seven chosen young women and so forth. So she ate bountifully, no doubt. Unlike Daniel, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, we're left to assume here that, you know, she ate what was put before her. There's no indication that she refused anything like those guys did.
Was there any religious significance to the myrrh or the
There may be. There may be, I don't know.
I was wondering how much she was participating in the religious.
But that's a good question. You know, that's another question that's left kind of open. There's a lot of questions left open in Esther that you think, you know, you think of all those kinds of questions that are answered with so many other individuals in the Bible. Joseph, Daniel, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, and so forth. But not so when it comes to the book of Esther. Esther and Mordecai, the main heroes of the book, Esther more so, obviously, those kind of questions aren't even touched upon. We have no idea what she thought, what he thought. Trish?
You do see her obedience.
You do see her obedience. She does obey Mordecai. Mordecai instructs her, don't tell anybody you're a Jew. She doesn't. Until, you know, we get to chapter 8 when the plan is revealed. So that's what takes place. She's beautified. And then you see the process in verse 13. When any particular woman's turn came, they could take whatever they wanted. What would that be? Once again, something to leave to the imagination. And so some have suggested that it was left ambiguous on purpose, that maybe it was just simply jewelry and clothing and other things, kind of as a, we'll put it in quotes, wedding gift. Maybe. Others are not so kind and think that the things that were, other things that they could have brought are things to, well, help the evening along, shall we say. Just think oysters. You'll go with that. And so, maybe, maybe not. Now, as I said, some think that what she kept, whatever the woman was at that given evening, was a wedding gift of sorts, but others were less gentle and were a little bit more blunt and basically called it payment for services rendered. But you know, we don't know. There's no description. It's another one of those things. She could take whatever she wanted, whatever it was. And so, she would go in. Next day, she would go back to the harem. And that's her life. Never to see her family again. Whatever plans she may have had. Nope. She's there. Forever. For the rest of her life. Now, if the king calls her back, the king calls her back. The king doesn't call her back. She's just there forever. She lived luxuriously in a palace, but in seclusion.
Sounds like slavery.
Pretty much. Comfortable slavery, but yeah. Michelle?
Well, I grew up in an area where a lot of Jewish people. And people would say, oh, they're such good business people. They take advantage of really good situations. Well, I think Esther saw her competition. She knew the spot for queen is open. And she makes her moves to see if she can fill that slot. I don't think, you know, she leaves it up to the eunuch. You know, what should I bring?
Yeah.
You know, she's working it. She's not just, maybe God makes her favor, but I think she's working the system.
There's probably some truth to that. And, you know, it's hard not to because, you know, she's gotten in with the king's eunuch who's kind of caring for her. And she decides, I'm not going to take anything. I'm going to take the advice of the eunuch. Who probably had, as we normally say, the inside scoop on things. So, because he had favor toward her, you know, hey, I'm going to help you out here. And he most likely did. And we have no idea what she brought with her. None. Whatever she brought with her, he suggested. And so the story just moves from there. Yeah.
Seems like that year would be kind of boring after a while.
Yeah, one would think. You know, even by today's standards, with everything that we have to keep us entertained, and I can't imagine what she would have done. I don't know what they would have done. So, yeah, so they go in, and then really now verse 14 describes they go in. And notice, so in verse 14, they would return to the second harem. So you got a first harem and you got a second harem. And not only that, you're left into the custody of a different eunuch. So they're separated. New, used. You know, I don't know how else to put it, but that's really what's being described here. So there it is. And then she would not go back to the king again unless the king delighted in her and she was summoned by name. So now we get to verse 15. All of that explains now what's about to happen with Esther. We bring Esther herself into the story. Okay? Notice how the author starts, verse 15. How does the author start verse 15? What's that?
When it's her turn.
When it's her turn. And then, what does he describe?
Her lineage.
Yeah, her lineage, again. And you're sitting there, you know, you think, well, I just read that just back a few verses. Why are we seeing this again? And I think it's the literary technique of the author to remind us once again, even though he just said it, here's Esther's lineage, reminding us of who she is. So, verse 15, even though it was back in verse 7 that we had her lineage. Now, the name of, this is where her name of her father comes in, the daughter of Abihail. But we already know that she's cousins with Mordecai, but yeah, here we are 7 verses later. That's kind of a short distance, and we're getting her lineage again. Good storyteller. So she goes in, she asks for nothing, as we mentioned, from Hegai, the king's eunuch, who had charge of the women, advised. And Esther, now notice this phrase here, Esther was winning favor in the eyes of all who saw her. So it's not just simply Hegai the eunuch and soon the king, but it's all, everybody. So she's gaining favor. She's gaining position. She's being set as this individual. Everything has led now, and we see the foreshadowing of what the obvious result is going to be. It's Esther's turn. Yeah, this is going to happen. And so verse 16, and when Esther was taken to King Ahasuerus, and that is very similar language to when you get to verse 8. Yeah, when the king's edict went out. With many young women, Esther also was taken into the king's palace. So you've got that similar language, and so far she seems to be described in passive ways. She's got no control over it. She's being taken. And that's how it's being presented. Okay? So again, that moral neutrality. What was going through Esther's mind? What do you think? And you know how I answer that? I don't know. The author doesn't give us any indication. Was she disgusted? Or was she thrilled? Yeah, she'll definitely get those privileges of being the queen. So is it a power play for her? For position? Yeah, well, we're really not told. We're not told at all. And
we're
so,
not even really told how old the women were or
no.
how, you know, if
she would have had any clue what was going on or how much they told them ahead of time what was going to happen.
Right. I would imagine that by the time, well, I mean, the edict was pretty clear. You know, you look at the beginning here, let the king appoint officers in all the provinces of his kingdom to gather all the beautiful young virgins to the harem in Susa, the capital, under the custody of Hegai, the king's eunuch, who is in charge of the women. Let their cosmetics be given to them, and let the young woman who pleases the king be queen instead of Vashti. So if she knew what the edict was, she knew why she was there. It could be that the edict went out and only the rulers, and they just said, gather the women. But at the same time, you know, they're there in Susa, they're being put into the king's harems. Everybody has to know where the king's harem is. Can't imagine that they didn't. It's not like an Area 51 type thing in New Mexico. They probably knew. Yep, that building right there, that's where the harem's kept. What's that?
Area 51.
Yeah, Area 51.
It's not New Mexico.
Oh, it's not New Mexico? I thought it was.
Nevada,
okay.
Are you sure?
You see, I don't follow all those conspiracy theory things, but Michelle?
If I was among pagans, pagans would say, well, sure, that's why they mentioned she's a Jew and she's a Mordecai again, because now she's about to show her Jewish stuff. She's about to show them, I'm gonna get the better end of this.
Yeah.
I mean, that's just how a lot of people would speak, you know, and there's nothing wrong with it. It's just, I'm going to do the best I can.
And I think that's a lot of the reason why the rabbis ranked her as one of the four most beautiful women. Because she obviously overcame all the Persian women that were brought in, or whatever nationality or province they came from. It was obvious that she had to have been beautiful, and there's no doubt that she was.
And there were lots. I mean, just this little turn, and when it's her turn, it just sounds like there's this conveyor belt going on.
Yeah, that's a way to put it, a conveyor belt. So,
what was normal marriageable age in that culture, do you know?
Probably pretty young.
Yeah, I mean, it talks about let all the beautiful young virgins be sought out for the king.
Yeah.
That would, in my mind, imply teenagers.
Yeah. I would probably venture to guess that that is the case, yeah.
The whole world around today, girls are married before the 20s.
Right.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Very common. So. Who would do that, right? Yeah. All right. So, there you have it. Esther then is all set. She takes with her only what Hegai advises. And now verse 16. And when Esther was taken to King Ahasuerus into his royal palace in the 10th month, which is the month of Tebeth, in the 7th year of his reign, the king loved Esther more than all the women, and she won grace and favor in his sight. More than all the virgins, so he set the royal crown on her head and made her queen instead of Vashti. She wins.
And so ended the contest.
And so ended the contest. She wins. And so what does the king do after the contest is over?
A feast.
Another feast. He likes to feast.
What about all the ones left that are still new?
Right.
They get to stay there. And I guess when he wants to call them, he will.
Queen or no queen?
Queen or no queen.
Well, it doesn't say he didn't call her after he checked out at all of them.
Right.
So he may have...
Maybe she was last. Who knows? But I would have supposed that somebody... And this is just my own speculation. I would suppose... You know, I hate to say it this way, but as the numbers dwindled, that one of his attendants said, you know, hey, king, we're starting to run out here. You want us to go get some more just in case, have a backup? Or, but she could have been last, but she could have been among the middle and then just left the rest. We don't know. That's another one. Whatever the case may be, one evening with the king, that did it.
But I thought that one of the eunuchs put some of his at like the top or something.
Well, it gave her a lot of favor, yeah. Whether or not it was top, meaning one of the first ones, probably not. Where there's no indication as to where she fit, who's number one, who's next, and so forth. But so he gives a feast, and we've seen before that this feast theme seems to be coming up again and again. And the book begins with a feast. The book ends with a feast. It's all about why there is the Feast of Purim. So we've got this thing that's just going on, more and more feasts. But notice how this feast goes. It was Esther's feast. He also granted remission of taxes to the provinces and gave gifts with royal generosity. So, in other words, you've got a government that's in debt and he spends money like it's water. You know, just
we don't
know anything about that, do we? You know. There's just nothing new under the sun, again. So he gives this feast, there's a queen, there's a new queen, and there we have it. We have Queen Esther now. Yes?
Maybe he looks through all of them to see which one he likes, then he picks them out.
Well, you know, it's described that one at a time they were brought in. Not that he went and scoped them all out.
Well, like, one was brought in, and then he went through all of them that they prepared. Like, in one at a time, and then he picked the one he liked best.
Well, that's kind of what happened, but once, the way the text reads, is that once Esther was there, that was it. He didn't send her back and then say, well, let's have a vote. Let's see, I like this one, and this one had this quality. Now, once Esther came, that was it. He was done. He picked her. So, Michelle?
Is myrrh a burial spice? Is it something to preserve?
It could be. It might be. I mean, they used a lot of spices in the embalming of bodies and so forth and wrapping, but I don't really know. So,
what's the significance of verse 19 in the context of this stuff? I mean, I'm sure you'll get to that next time. But what is that talking about?
When they were gathered together the second time. That's a good question. Second time for what? So, they must have came back, you know, I don't know. At least not initially, I mean, I'll check on that, but the emphasis there, now we start getting into Mordecai and his position in the court.
It seems like a non sequitur to me.
Yeah.
Because I don't know what it's referring to.
Yeah. Wonder if there's something vague in the Hebrew there. So, let's check. Not that I'll necessarily have an answer, but there does seem to be a number, by the way, as I'm looking this up, there does seem to be some Hebrew idioms that are used. Like some of the words and combinations of words that, if you take literally, don't seem to fit. So it does seem that there are some idioms that are used there, ways that we wouldn't quite say it that way. Anyway, verse 19. Let's see what we've got here. Gathered. And, yeah, the young virgins were gathered a second time. Then it goes right into Mordecai. I mean, there's nothing fancy about it when they were gathered a second time.
Is it possible that it's like, they were gathered initially. He went through the first lot of them, the second gathering.
And that's
so
possible.
Sort of going back in time for a second. This may have happened during Esther's beautifying period, and then Mordecai reveals it.
Oh, so you're
by
thinking
the time after she's become queen?
That's possible, but I don't know that that's required in the order.
Right, I don't either. It's just
in my Bible, it has a note that he's enlarging the harem. The second group of virgins is just he's wanting to enlarge the harem, and that there's a connection between the second group and the assassination plot.
Yeah, there probably is to some degree. At the very least, he's gathering them for his own purposes. But that part's not spelled out. But at least sets the stage and provides the framework within which the plot becomes uncovered. So we'll look at that plot next week. Now Mordecai saves the day, and then what happens immediately after that in the beginning of chapter 3. So, and that's where you get you start seeing some of the twists and turns that take place that you just wouldn't expect. Your mind is thinking as you hear a story and you think, wait a minute, what just happened here? Now we know the story familiar enough that we tend not to think that way. Plus, when we do our daily Bible readings, we tend to read chapter to chapter, one day to the next. And so the flow of thought given by the author is sometimes cut off when we do that. Some places there are good chapter breaks, don't get me wrong. But I don't think the one between chapter 2 and 3 is a good one. So, and we'll see why next week. Any other thoughts or comments?
Were the girls sent back to their promises?
No. Nope. They stayed in the other castle, Talus, forever, or for the rest of their lives. And if the king never called them, they just lived there in seclusion for the rest of their lives.
It became property.
Property. Yeah.
I know, but they all stayed there. But couldn't they interact and talk with each other?
I'm sure they did to a degree, but, you know, that's not... not so sure that that's a lifestyle that anybody that I know of would be interested in for very long. So... All right.